Good evening. This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, two more miners killed by employer negligence in West Virginia. But first, New York City transit workers turned down contract negotiated between TWU Local 100 leadership and Metropolitan Transportation Authority.
Our two guests, and one of them, Tim Skermerhorn, who's a member of the rank and file. He's a long-term labor activist, both in the union and in the labor movement in general. And Ainsley Stewart, who's a vice president of equipment, TWU Local 100, to discuss the issues of this contract and where transit workers go from here. And obviously, your perspective was that the contract should not have been voted up, and maybe we can start by your thoughts on why.
The membership of Local 100 is much more intelligent than some people seem to give to them, and they could actually read a contract and know what it means to them as it relates to this 2005 tentative contract agreement, especially surrounding the issue of the 1.5% healthcare premium, which is something for the first time being introduced to us. That has been pretty much problematic and more or less the center of the entire problem. And more troubling is the fact that we struck because union leadership said that not the right thing to do to have a two-tier pension system where we would pay 2% and new hires would pay 6%. And that within itself raised even further trouble after the strike when the tentative contract agreement came back with the 1.5% meaning a different amount for a person earning $40,000 versus a person earning, let's say, double that amount, for example. Okay, if you earn $40,000, you have to pay a 1.5% premium. That's $600. If you earn $80,000, you're going to be paying $1,200 for the same level of benefit and absolutely no changes to your current healthcare plan that you have here today. That is where most of the problems is centered around. For a worker who starts here at age 40, he or she finds himself in a situation of having to pay 25 years, the 1.5%, going to age 65 at the time when Social Security kicks in. And when Social Security kicks in, it means that Medicare covers you. And for that 25 years of contribution, which could run anywhere between $40,000 and $50,000, depending on how much the healthcare cost increases over that period of time. I mean, it's like if you're paying $40,000 to $50,000 for absolutely nothing in exchange. So members recognize that. You know, this is an issue that has actually troubled the members very much, and members are very concerned as to where we're at and where we're headed, and they've pretty much voted that way.
Well, it's clear that the membership did vote it down, and that the health care portion was one of the main things that got them to do that. But the question that I have and a lot of people have is, what is the strategy now to get a better contract? The contract that was voted down, bottom line, didn't meet the cost of living increase over this year or the projected one for next year. But what is the strategy to get a better deal?
And Tim, if I can just reference that a little further also, particularly since, as you know, the MTA has already said that its application today for binding arbitration, what that has meant in the past, certainly for transit, for the firefighters, for teachers, other times that there have been a voting down of contract and a renegotiation, has meant that essentially there has been a changing of words, but there hasn't been a better contract for the membership. So where does one go from here?
The first thing is that we have to have the negotiator of our union have to be in better touch with the ranks of the union. At least half the people who voted, plus seven, saw what they thought was a good deal as an unacceptable deal. The package of givebacks contained in there was unacceptable to the majority of us, a slim majority by the vote, but a majority nevertheless. There has to be a dialogue in the union on how we go forward. What constitutes a good deal? Because right now, a lot of us are at odds with what our negotiators constituted a good deal. Then there's the process of some mobilization. We should be rallying at the MTA headquarters. We should invite all of that support we had during our strike to come with us and rally against give back. In terms of binding arbitration, that's going to be a process. They will possibly be back at the bargaining table. There may be mediators sent in. And there's going to be some discussion of what's actually on the table. I know that in people that I talk to, the 37-month contract, well, that's a pet peeve of mine, But the
why?
The health benefit. Hmm?
That's because you lose that Christmas pivotal point of calling a strike, potentially.
And the fact is, you don't have to look at New York City Transit. You could look around the country with austerity budgets and neoliberal governments and know that our negotiations in the future are going to look more like the distant past than the more recent past. We're going to need all the leverage that we can have because negotiations are going to be tough.
You know, starting way back with the Daily News, the Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Times, and so on, where the headlines went from MTA gravy train to push Roger off the train to real contempt and condemnation of the transport workers. Their leadership, certainly the issue of race, played a significant factor in the condemnation of Bloomberg, the political aspirations of Pataki in the national arena. I mean, you
and don't
folks
forget
have
Pahoritz in the Post calling for the firing of us all.
Absolutely.
And the arrest of thousands.
That's right. There was a PATCO scenario.
I'm still waiting for us to start boycotting the Post of all the rags.
We'll take that one up next week. But seriously, you have a hard row to hoe at this point. The media, the public sentiment, as people have a recollection of being turned by the millions into pedestrians and are influenced by the mass media and unfortunately don't have the best sensitivity as workers themselves or members of the working class. Do you have the fortitude? So how do you really overcome that sentiment and push against those obstacles for a better contract?
I don't think that the media that you talked about is an expression of public sentiment. Mm-hmm. One of the strengths of our strike was tremendous public support, not necessarily through the organizations that people may have been represented by, but people walked our picket lines. Support was verbally stated for us every day. People on their jobs, like in schools, teachers would take up collections, contribute to our efforts. I think that's because we took a stand against the givebacks where everybody's under attack. The issues of pensions and health care are the subject of an offensive by the employer. We had a lot of support. In terms of the media, one of the reasons that we have been targeted so is that we are not going quietly into the paradigm set up for us that we're going to give back these things and accept what the employers have in store for us. Can we win? Yes, if we do the right things. The beginning is that we have to consolidate our force among transit workers. There has to be genuine dialogue and hearing in the union itself. And going back to the bargaining table, we're going to have to strategize. I'm not going to talk about specific tactics here, but we chose to take the path that we're going to fight. We did that when we authorized the leadership of the union to strike. And this is no time to turn back on that particular perspective, that we're not accepting the perspective of the employers and their media that everybody has to give back now.
By the way, does it matter that the international union had been an oppositional force and had been critical?
It matters a great deal, and that's probably a subject for another effort that we'll be participating in.
Yeah. Now, Ainsley, you're on the executive board. Had there been ideas on the executive board? What's your reaction to what Tim is calling for, all-out mobilization, both in terms of the rank and file of the union, but also alliances with the working class in the city? What do you think needs to be done?
I think essentially that if you were to look back at the contract offer prior to the strike, health benefit was never an issue. It was only the issue of how much should new hires pay. And it's only after the strike that the healthcare premium came into the picture. And it didn't come into the picture because the employer asked for it. It came in because it was offered up as a means to settle a strike, if I'm not mistaken. And I say that to say to you that within itself offers a lot of room for bridging the gap. I firmly believe that the union administration needs to open the process whereby, rather than excluding vice presidents who are constitutionally elected officers from the bargaining table, that we be allowed to be there and partake equally in the interest of the members we represent and advocate, you know, as to the direction where we're supposed to go, rather than just doing it upon yourselves and just springing it upon us at the last moment to run back into a similar chaotic situation. Members have expressed that they don't want to pay for health benefits in most cases. And in some cases, they're saying that, however, if there's any payment that is being done for it, it must be meaningful. I mean, we don't have full medical coverage in retirement, which is what this contract is playing up. We just don't have it. We only have coverage up till through the pre-Medicare period, and most transit workers retire at age 62 for the most part, not necessarily at 55 when you're eligible for retirement. And so it leaves them 3 years to collect benefits from their contributions, and that is what has been a major sticking point. So again, I believe that there's a lot of room coming from the employer, in the sense that the employer never did demanded that we pay for our health care benefits, even though it's projected that it will to bring in $120 million for them over 3 years.
Far be it from me to throw the fear of the Taylor Act, the fear of the fines and all these things, but they are a reality. There's a lot clearly at stake for the workers and what it portends for the entire union movement, as far as I'm concerned, which has been so badly beaten up in the past years. I guess when you vote down the contract, you make the determination that it's worth it. But is there anything affirmative about this contract? Is there any more that you think that you can really squeeze out of the MTA? And of course, Ken and I had always been talking, my goodness, if you can't get it out of the MTA now with a surplus of $1 billion, I don't know when the heck you can. But I am filled with a certain trepidation about this move to vote down the contract.
The way I see it here is that the leadership of this union, with the support of the members, have to go back to the transit authority and essentially say to them, look, our members are rejecting this whole thing of us having to pay $120 million over 3 years for health care premiums, and that we must come to some better deal. Only until the leadership of the local takes such a position that the transit authority will then decide where they're going to go from here. But if the union leadership decides to continue agreeing to just throw the 1.5% to us, okay, which is a bad precedence for labor throughout New York City, I mean, you know, it's a major problem. It will continue to be a major problem.
We've rejected a contract before, just to call up a little history. And it wasn't after a strike, but the 91 contract, which got negotiated late, we rejected the deal. And in the media, they talk about we ratified a second deal with minor adjustment. One of those minor adjustments is that we got a raise instead of a bonus, $1,000. A lot of us think it's significant to get a raise, even a small one, when there was no raise in the first year of the contract. There were also some other changes that were important. While we don't think that in this period we're going to break the bank, there certainly have to be adjustments to this contract, because even in the context of being post-strike, people saw the package is unacceptable.
But the question is, will the MTA go along, and what's going to pressure them to do it? And we don't have too much time. We have maybe half a minute each, but that's the question of the day. What's going to get the MTA to move?
The leadership of the local have to mobilize the members and let it be known to the transit authority that the members are saying that 1.5% must go. Up until the leadership does that, we're in the same position and we're in trouble.
I agree, and the approach has to be that we have a problem unless we can be presented with an acceptable contract.
Tim Schermerhorn, we thank you very much, and Ainsley Stewart, for being with us and making your voices heard.
If you see me stumble, don't stand back and look on. Give your hands to struggle.
An agonizing 2-day wait came to a tragic end when rescue workers found the bodies of two miners who were trapped by a fire that began on a conveyor belt 900 feet underground. 19 miners had escaped after a fire deep in the bowels of the Arankoma coal mine in Melville, West Virginia. We'll provide an update on the investigation of this disaster and find out what happened with the government probe of the tragedy at the Sago mine as well, and what needs to be done, most importantly, to safeguard the lives and health of miners. And we welcome Tony Appergard, former general counsel of the Kentucky Department of Mines.
Tony, we had said about the Sago mine that that seemed like a disaster waiting to happen. The conditions there and the citations from the Mining Commission and the minuscule fines that they were given for these violations. Can we say the same about the Alma mine owned by Massey? What, in your mind, caused this situation?
Well, if you look at the citation history of the Arankoma mine, certainly it wasn't as serious as the citation history of the Sago mine. There was not as many serious violations that had been issued by MSHA. However, there were some disturbing violations. Nonetheless, just since the start of 2005, MSHA had issued over 100 citations, and 51 of those were deemed significant and substantial. And there was five accumulations of combustible materials violations, including three in December, and also 12 ventilation violations, including nine since November, and five firefighting equipment violations. The accumulation of combustible materials, those are particularly significant in this case because the fire did happen on the belt line, and generally those belt line fires are caused by accumulations of combustible materials, where you have loose coal that's fallen off of the belt line and it's allowed to accumulate and it's not shoveled and removed, and friction occurs and the friction will start a fire. And then, of course, you have the combustible materials there which propagate the fire. In this instance, Ken, a very disturbing development in the Bush administration probably contributed to this disaster, and that was in 2004, the Bush administration promulgated a new rule which allowed the belt line entry in coal mines to also be used as the intake air entry. To try to explain that a little further, ever since 1969, Congress had mandated that the belt line entry in a mine be separated from the intake air. And intake air is the fresh air that is pumped into the mine. It can be 25 or up to 50,000 cubic feet a minute, so it's high velocity air, and it goes the whole way to the mine face, however far away that may be. It could be 1,000 feet, it could be 15,000 feet. And it goes in great quantity, so it goes up to the faces where the coal is being cut and sweeps out the methane and the coal dust and the other contaminants, and then brings it out on the other side of the mine through what's called the return entry. In this case, in 2004, the Bush administration, rather than requiring separate intake air courses, said that coal companies now could use their belt line entry for their intake air course. So the company doesn't have to dig this intake air course. They save a lot of money, but the high velocity air is being taken right over the belt line. And the problem with that is apparent. I mean, it really defies common sense that if you have a fire that erupts on a belt line, if you have 25,000 cubic feet of air per minute pumped into that belt line entry, you're going to spread that fire. And I'm afraid that that may be what happened in this case. We'll have to wait and see what the investigation said. But at Arankoma, they were using the belt line entry for their intake air course.
Tony, one of the things that kept annoying me as I read the papers and the various accounts of this tragedy was they kept saying, well, there were 22 mine deaths in 2005, and that's a record low. And they kept using that as though that were somehow going to pacify the righteous anger that should be there about this enormously dangerous job and the kind of legislation that hasn't passed and the kind of safety precautions that have not been taken. I'm still amazed at the reality, for example, that, I mean, going back to the Sagal mine, that there's only a few hours or even less of air available to people who are trapped in that situation, when clearly that's something that could be remedied and taken into account to provide a better air supply, a longer air supply for people should they need to be rescued.
Well, you're right on all counts there. First of all, the number of deaths last year were a record low, but of course for those 22 families who lost a coal miner, the fact that there was quote-unquote only 22 deaths is not very comforting. Also, one thing I learned a long time ago in mine safety work is you should never brag about your safety record, because it can change in the blink of an eye. So while the Bush administration was touting the fact that only 22 miners had died in coal mines last year, now we're barely two-thirds of the way through the first month of the year, and we already have 15 deaths, 14 in West Virginia and one in Kentucky. And certainly at the Aracoma mine, those deaths were preventable. That accident was preventable. It never should have happened. I say that because all you need to do to prevent a mine fire on a belt line is to keep your belt line clean. Most mines have workers assigned, and that's their only job, is to shovel along the belt line and to apply rock dust, which is pulverized limestone that keeps the coal dust down so that it's not suspended in the air. It's a basic safety requirement and apparently was being ignored in this mine. So really, I think the fingers in this case clearly point at the Aracoma mine at A.T. Massey. And I would say there's probably a high degree of negligence involved in this case. I think that the report ultimately will bear that out.
Tony, of course, now all the politicians, the governor of West Virginia, the president of the United States are saying, yes, we have to do something about mine safety. But to my ears, what I'm hearing so far is they're talking about improving the rescue operation once there's an accident. And I don't hear too much of them trying to say, well, what should we do about making the mines safer to begin with?
Well, that's a good point, too. I mean, I applaud all of the legislation that West Virginia enacted today. Those are all things that need to be done, but that is true. They're all after the fact in terms of these are devices that will help once there is a mine fire or an explosion. Where we need to get to in this country is preventing explosion, preventing mine fires, and I think the way we do that is by tougher enforcement of the laws we have. Unfortunately, I don't think we're getting that from the Bush administration. You saw an appalling example of arrogance on the part of the administration when the acting head of MSHA walked out of the hearings that were being held by the subcommittee. Chairman Spector asked the acting head of MSHA to stay for another hour so that he could ask him follow-up questions. And Mr. Dye said that they were too busy to stay, that they had pressing business. Chairman Spector pointed out the senators were pretty busy, too, and they had a lot of pressing business and listed a litany of bills, the Patriot Act and Immigration Act, et cetera, that needed work on, but he thought it was important that he stay for another hour. And Mr. Dye walked out of that hearing, and he was not subpoenaed, so he was free to do so. But I just think it shows the arrogance of the Bush administration. They don't want to be questioned about what happened. They also issued on their a press release today where they're defending the actions they took at Sago prior to the explosion, which is highly unusual. Usually they issue their report and then answer questions, but I think they're very defensive. They know there was problems, and they're trying to put out that fire, so to speak, before it starts. They don't want the criticism to get too loud.
Drock, Ken mentioned it a moment ago, but Governor Manchin, he's talking about passing bills to improve rapid response to mine emergencies and set up electronic tracking technology for lost miners and reserve oxygen stations underground, but nothing that would have a more inherently safe environment for the miners to work in. They didn't talk about any use of the technological advances in belt systems themselves and using better, you know, rollers and bearings. That's one thing, but at the same time, in July 2002, the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, withdrew a proposal to tighten testing for belt materials. The proposal had been meant to significantly reduce or eliminate belt fires like the one that did trap the two miners on Thursday.
That's true. I mean, it was a regulation that was proposed during the Clinton years, and it was proposed because of the high number of Beltline fires that had occurred in recent years. The proposal would have required flame-resistant conveyor belts, and as you said, that proposed regulation was withdrawn by the Bush administration, and I think when they published in the Federal Register the reason for it being withdrawn, they said that there had been a decrease in the number of Beltline fires. I mean, obviously, industry was opposed to the regulation because it would have been a little more expensive to have flame-resistant conveyor belts. But again, it was short-sighted. And basically what the Bush administration has done, they've loaded MSHA with officials who used to work in the coal industry. All the top people in MSHA, the political appointees, they all come from industry. And they're defeating the regulations that have been proposed to help miners and passing regulations such as allowing the conveyor belt entry to be used for intake air that are beneficial to operators. And I really think that we're seeing the fruits of those failures. It's basically the legacy of Dave Lariski, who was the head of MSHA during those years. The death toll went down for a few years, but I think now we're seeing the consequences of trying to bend over and backwards to favor industry to the detriment of mine safety.
Well, it's kind of like miners die and management temporarily cries but does nothing of any substantive nature to change the conditions of work to make it safer in that very, very dangerous job. Tony Oppegard, former general counsel, Kentucky Department of Mines, it's a pleasure to have you with us, and thank you for all that you do for mine safety, and we'll continue after the headlines fade to look at this critical issue of occupational safety and health hazards and what can be done to eliminate them. It's been a pleasure.
Give your hands to Strava. Give your hands.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.